present this work here, which I did with Logan Nayagam, who's somewhere in between IAS and Bangalore, and Mukund Rangamani at UC Davis now. Okay, so why am I interested in hydrodynamics? So it's a very common situation in almost every field of physics that we talk about systems where we don't have full knowledge about the system because, I don't know, you restrict to low energies or maybe you traced out some part of the system and things like this. And this typically leads to phenomena like dissipation, fluctuations, entanglement, and perhaps problems with unitarity and all such things. And these are generically dissipative systems out of equilibrium, which are pretty hard to understand in general, at least in a systematic way, in a field theoretic way. And hydrodynamics provides us a window into these sort of theories because it is a very constrained theory where we can actually make some progress in understanding such situations. And there's a structure emerging now. We're beginning to see a very intricate and very interesting structure underlying hydrodynamics and probably generalizing to many more things. And in this talk, I want to give you, I want to really study hydrodynamics itself and give you some idea of how to think about the structure of hydrodynamics and then how to understand this in a general context. Okay, I'm going to start by reviewing what I mean by hydrodynamics and what's the problem I want to solve in this talk. And then this is the main part of this talk is actually solving this problem. And I'm going to give you an example and give you an outlook for some interesting features that may emerge. So as I said, hydrodynamics is also a nice theory because it's very generic. So you can basically start with any microscopic theory you like. And if you look at the theory on large scales, when fluctuations only happen at length scales larger than some mean free path or something, then you don't see the details of the microscopic theory anymore. All you see is you can describe the entire system just in terms of some macroscopic fluid variables. So there's a velocity field U, which describes the velocity of the fluid, and there's a temperature field and maybe a chemical potential field if the fluid carries some global charge. And you can put this system on an arbitrary but slowly varying fixed background geometry and gauge field for charged systems. And then what you do, this is the established framework, how hydrodynamics works. You define an energy momentum tensor and a charge current, which you can expand in derivatives. So these subscripts indicate a derivative expansion because derivatives are small in this regime. So you have an energy momentum tensor and a charge current, and the dynamics you impose on the theory is this. Okay, so this is basically just conservation of these currents modulo some joule heating term here on the right-hand side. Okay, so the way to describe a general fluid is by writing down these tensor structures as functionals of these variables in blue at any order in derivatives. So for instance, at lowest order with zero derivatives, the most general thing I can write down, there are two possible tensor structures at this order, or a third one if you have a charge here, which I can build out of the metric and these U vectors. And each of these tensor structures multiplies some transport coefficients and energy density, and there's a pressure here and a charge density. And you can do this at any order in derivatives, and this describes the theory. Okay, there's another subtlety. So it was realized by Son and Sorovka, I think, that if your microscopic theory has some anomalies, some quantum anomalies, then you can actually see them in the macroscopic hydrodynamic description. You can see them by means of a non-conservation of these currents. So they will play a, a small role, but I should put them here for to be general. Okay. So I will later claim that I have a solution to hydrodynamics. By this, I do not mean, I think this is important to emphasize, I do not mean to solve the problem, to calculate these transport coefficients that describe the transport of any particular fluid for any particular microscopic theory. That I'm not going to do that, and I'm also certainly not going to solve the fluid equations. But what I'm going to do is I want to write down what is the most general thing you can have here, the most general constitutive relations at any order in the derivative expansion, but such that whatever you do, it has to be consistent with the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, and this is implemented in hydrodynamics in this way. You have you postulate the existence of an entropy current JS, which you can also expand in derivatives. The lowest order would be just an entropy density in the direction of the fluid flow U. And then there are higher order corrections, and this entropy current has to have positive definite divergence. That's a local form of the second law of thermodynamics. And this is an on-shell constraint. This tilde will always mean it's an on-shell equation. So if you actually impose this condition, you have to use the equations of motion here. So this will constrain these expansions. And this will give you relations among the coefficients that can show up here. So for instance, if you do this, if you impose this constraint just on the zeroth order ideal fluid I wrote down here, you will find that this constraint imposes just some thermodynamic Euler relation. And then there are more intricate constraints which show up at higher orders and derivatives. The most familiar maybe is that shear and bulk viscosities can never be negative. That follows from this constraint. And there are more interesting constraints, and they show up at any order in derivatives. S, small s, you mean?
Yeah.
Is the entropy density, so that would be the coefficient which determines the entropy current at lowest order. It's just some function of temperature and chemical potential. It's free. It only it has to satisfy this. Otherwise, it's not consistent with the second law. But other than that, it can be anything. Okay. So what I'm going to do in this talk, I'm basically going to solve this problem for you. I'm going to classify every kind of hydrodynamic transport, so all constitutive relations that can ever show up at any order in derivatives, and construct them explicitly, such that this entropy constraint is manifestly built in. You don't have to impose this by hand anymore, which is very complicated. So for instance, this analysis, finding the constraints of this condition at second order in derivatives, so five interesting relations, but this is a very complicated analysis. And we want to write down these constitutive relations such that this constraint is built in automatically. And then in the end, I will argue that the best way to understand how this classification works is by thinking about an emergent gauge symmetry, which organizes things. And then I'm very happy to have the opportunity to give a second talk next Friday in the strings group meeting, where we'll really give a field theoretic argument for where such a symmetry could come from, how we understand this classification, and how we understand everything as a Wilsonian field theorist who wants to think of hydrodynamics as the generic low energy theory. And there will be all sort of interesting structure involving things like supersymmetry and topological sigma models just coming out of the mathematical structure of the problem. And via ADS CFT, all these questions are dual to questions about black holes and dissipation with gravity with horizons and all these things. Okay, so let me now try to explain to you how to classify solutions to the problem I just described. And we had a charge current so far to draw the general picture, but from now on I will talk about neutral fluids. Okay, you can add global charges to this problem. that can be done. It's all in this paper, but it just gives more and more equations. Okay, so the thing is, how do we think about this on-shell entropy constraint? The most convenient way to think about it, it turns out, is by taking it off-shell, so we don't have to impose equations of motion anymore. Okay, so instead of classifying, writing down these tensor structures, energy momentum tensors, which satisfy on-shell equations, and then imposing that this be positive definite separately, I will just look at this equation, which is an off-shell equation, and you can immediately see that if you go on-shell, if you impose the dynamical equations of motion, this just means you set this bracket to zero, the conservation of the stress tensor up to this anomaly contribution, maybe. Okay, so if you go on-shell, then this bracket is zero, and this condition reduces to the constraint that the gradient, the divergence of JS be positive definite.
Is there anything special about that particular equation? You provided the second term in many ways such that it would go to zero on shell. So is there anything so particular that...
So a priori, this would be this beta you would think of as some Lagrange multiplier. So you want to solve two equations, one of which is an inequality. And the idea is just to combine them in this way. So this is the inequality guy, and you add the equation with a Lagrange multiplier. Right. And then it's a...
more general. The whole concept of second equations, right? You're protecting them to the Kolmogorov direction, right?
So at this point, at this stage, beta is any vector. So this does not constrain it. It's just any Lagrange multiplier vector. And it's a theorem in linear algebra that solving this problem is actually equivalent to solving the on-shell problem before. So one direction of this equivalence you can see very easily, that if you go on-shell, then this gives you the equation you want. And the converse is actually also true. So this is that's what you were asking. Now, there's a natural choice for this Lagrange multiplier, which is by aligning this Lagrange multiplier with the fluid velocity and normalized by inverse temperature. So this is some, this beta is some, its scale is set by the temperature and it goes with the fluid. This turns out to be the most natural choice. So the task is now to solve this equation, so meaning give the entropy current and the energy momentum tensor at any order in derivatives as functionals of these fluid dynamical fields, this thermal vector and the background geometry. And ideally, what we would like to define this solution by writing down an effective action, some action which we can just vary such that its variation defines for us the stress tensor, and the conservation laws associated with the symmetries of the action would give us the equations of motion we want. So we're going to classify now solutions to this problem. And it turns out that this marginal case where delta, the total entropy, the total off-shell entropy production, if you wish, is exactly zero. I refer to that as the adiabaticity equation, which has a particularly rich structure. We will see that the solutions which have actually delta larger than zero are actually easy to understand. Okay, so let's first look at delta equals zero. And okay, before I start, one more technical thing. So this is the equation we want to solve with the right-hand side being zero, no entropy production. Instead of talking about an entropy current, we can also talk about a free energy current, G, which is just almost the same as the entropy current. Okay, you subtract some canonical piece, which is given by the stress tensor. But it will often just be more convenient to talk about the free energy current G instead of JS. So the grand canonical version of this equation in terms of G now looks like this, where where you see there's a lead derivative of the metric along this vector beta. And here, this guy with a perp, that's again the anomaly contribution. If the system doesn't have anomalies, then this is not there. Okay. So this is basically the summary of, you can see there are of the classes of solutions that we find for this problem. And I will now go through this and explain where this comes from and what these classes are. And so let's start with the anomalies, because anomalies always give us this extra piece here, which is a bit confusing and actually easy to deal with. Okay. So the idea for now would just be to get rid of anomalies once and forever, because the number of constitutive relations which know about anomalies are finite anyway. Okay, so I can encode anomalies in some anomaly polynomial, and that tells me what solutions to this problem know about anomalies, and it's just some finite number, so we can just write them down and then forget about them. Okay, so and the statement which was first shown by these people was that if you have any general solution to this equation, you can always split off a particular solution which takes care of the anomalies. Okay, so there's a particular solution in blue here, which satisfies the equation with the anomaly, with this red term. And once I add this particular solution to the general G and the general T, then I can just forget about the anomalous term. Okay. So this particular solution is typically some finite number of terms which are determined by the structure of the anomaly. Okay. So from now on, I want to forget about the anomalies. The anomalies are now gone in this equation, and we can look at non-anomalous fluids. Okay. Now, the statement here is that there's a dissipative class. So only one of all these classes actually knows about dissipation, meaning that there's this delta, the entropy production, is actually positive and not zero. And there's only one class because dissipation is actually much, much simpler than you may imagine. And this was first realized by Jayantani Bhattacharya. So what kind of solutions can actually give you a positive delta? There are three type of terms, and okay, there's a lot of information here. So let's look at this example. Yeah, let's look at this example first. So say you have some stress tensor with one derivative, okay, which has some bulk viscosity here, and multiplies some one derivative tensor structure. So this theta is just gradient of the U. Now, if you plug in this energy momentum tensor into your equation here, you will find that this gives an entropy production, which is not zero. It goes like the transport coefficient times this theta squared. Now you observe that the temperature is positive anyway, and theta squared is also manifestly positive. So in order for this delta to be positive definite, what you need to require is that zeta be positive definite. Okay? This is the only way that this expression can be positive. So from the second law constraint that this be positive, you find a constraint on the bulk viscosity.
I'm not alone because I'm considering that this should be ordered by order, so that you can ignore the other contribution. I mean, the combinations of terms should be positive, but you're...
Right. You could have combinations. But you can reduce a combination to a single term by changing the basis of tensors you use.
No, I'm considering the second order, but you're going to assume that the Debye expansion applies, and so then these other terms will be subdued.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the next point here. So yeah. So this happens at second order in the, yeah. This is this type one where you have where the second law constraint gives you an inequality. gives you an inequality constraint. And now the interesting statement from these papers is that these inequality type constraints only show up at leading order. If you go to higher orders, there will not be any inequality constraints. But there's a proof in this paper, or a different proof in our paper, that this is true. And the way it works is, so if you look at some higher order object now, with some transport coefficient gamma and some second order tensor, some tensor with two derivatives, which gives you a delta that goes like theta cubed, then, as you said, then this is suppressed compared to that one. Okay, so although theta cubed does not have a definite sign, you don't have to constrain this coefficient because it's suppressed in derivatives against something you have already controlled.
I would
make the assumption that the transport coefficients respect the derivative expansion.
But
that's based, that's in the assumption of the height of the whole framework, right? We expand in derivatives these tensor structures, and we assume that whatever multiplies them is something order one.
So suppose that theta vanishes, but derivative of at a given point, but derivative of theta is non-zero, and then you might have a competition at a given point where, say, derivative of theta squared.
Yeah, that's something. That's a different structure then, which is not constrained by this one.
But it's subleading derivatives, but locally.
Yeah.
It's so, a dominant distribution.
So the interesting statement of Shayantani is that you can always add a correction to the entropy current, such that delta can be assembled into objects which you already know from lower orders. You can always add something to the entropy current such that this delta takes these is either a total square, or it's a total square times something higher order. I will give an explicit construction shortly, which maybe makes this more clear.
Yeah. So this, essentially you're taking this lead derivative of the metric with this Lagrange multiplier. Am I correct in that? The spectrum beta?
Yeah, so beta at this point is the fluid velocity rescaled by temperature. That's the natural, yeah.
So in principle, you get a different answer if you use a different Lagrange multiplier.
Why is that natural? Why is that the one you use?
There's always a field redefinition freedom in the hydrodynamic description. You can always do certain field redefinitions. And basically, by making the choice that the Lagrange multiplier be beta, I'm using up some of this field redefinition freedom. So that's basically what happened. But it's not really a gauge. It's a certain freedom in your description. It's some redundancy if you really. Yeah. Okay. So this is this type two sort of thing where there is something that produces entropy, but it's subleading. It's already dominated by something else. So the second law constraint does not give you any condition.
It seems like you're ignoring the contribution from the entropy curve. What's the logic? I don't understand the logic. So you're saying that stress energy at this point.
Right, yeah. In general, I have to take care of that. Yeah. So in this example, I think G is just zero. You can choose G to be just zero.
But you're comparing the different contributions from TU and arguing that some of them are small compared to others. So why is it that I can just ignore all of the contributions from the entropy?
So for any t, my task is to construct a g such that this works. And in this example, I can g take just to be zero, and that would work. But in more general cases, of course, the g is some complicated thing. Yeah. Which, yeah, I will get back to this in a second, how to construct this. But before, let me just mention one more, this third type of thing, that you have a sign indefinite term, something like this. But what Michal mentioned, that it could be that this is not theta cubed, which is the same form as something you already controlled, but this could be some new tensor structure, something else. So you have something sign indefinite, which you actually have to constrain. And if this was sign indefinite, then the only way to make this non-negative is by choosing the coefficient to be zero. Okay. So in this way, this inequality constraint can actually give you equality constraints. Okay. And this is something quite familiar again. So if you have so here's this ideal fluid example again, and if for these constitutive relations you compute the entropy production, you will find it takes this form. And now the tensor structures you multiply are objects which are not square or something. So they're not manifestly positive. And they're not constrained by something lower order. So the only way to make this expression non-negative is by choosing the coefficients to be zero. Otherwise, there could always be some fluid configuration which violates the second law. Okay, so there are combinations of transport coefficients which are zero, and here you recognize these combinations as some standard thermodynamic relations. Similar things show up at higher orders. Okay, so these equality type constraints, they show up at any order. But these inequality type constraints only show up at leading order. And in this sense, the inequality constraint of the second law is, in this sense, it's simpler than you may imagine.
It's just that the dominant contribution to this equation is on the linear order.
Yeah, that's the only one you have to constrain. Yeah. Okay, so these combinations of coefficients, they multiply some tensor structure here. This is what we call class HF, where F stands for forbidden. So this is this down here. These are tensor structures in the energy momentum tensor, which you can write down by symmetry, but they're not allowed by the second law. So their coefficient has to vanish.
For this example, what are you using for G sigma on to zero?
So here I'm using this J mu S, which I can translate into a G sigma, which would not be zero. Yeah.
One thing, you know, J, you don't know what J is, so you have chosen a different J, in which case I might have gotten some terms that will cancel. So how am I playing this game?
So for this energy momentum tensor, I want to find some J for which I can make the second law work. That's the.
Right, but this J, that you change, you use a different J, you only have got this cancellation, and then what would have you decided in that case? That J was wrong, and you had to keep looking for it.
Well, there's not. This is basically the only J you can choose, right? Because without using any derivatives, the only thing you can do, this is the only vector you have. So the only form for J at this order in derivatives is this.
I could have gradient of T.
I mean, at zeroth order, you're not allowed to use gradients. Yeah. This is the only form that's allowed.
Then you just normalize.
The only thing you can do is field redefinitions, shift S or something like that. But this doesn't essentially change it. Okay, but let me get back to this class D, the dissipation, for a second, and make this a bit more explicit. So if we want to construct solutions to this equation which are here positive definite, look at this kind of solution. This is not the most general thing, but almost. If you have a T mu nu, which is this Lie derivative kind of thing, and a and some tensor structure, so some tensor n built of out of beta and g with these symmetries, then and g to be zero, then if you plug in these two guys in this equation, you get delta is this tensor, the symmetric part of this tensor, under changing the two pairs of indices, and then times this Lie derivative object squared. Okay. So any constitutive relation of this form gives you something that's manifestly the square of Lie beta g times some other tensor which may involve higher order, higher derivatives.
So what if you try plugging in an opposite sign, t mu nu, and then
you want to change
then
the
add,
sign?
And, yeah, we'll change the sign so you get it.
Which one? This sign or this sign?
The overall sign.
The overall.
You had that. I mean, this is what gave you the sign on that coefficient a couple of slides ago. And then put in. Can you add in like a g sigma that would cancel that? I mean, like the. Can you add in an entropy current that would then cancel that? Because you're setting the entropy current to zero and saying, well, you want it to be zero and still have second.
Well,
level.
Okay.
See what I'm saying?
Perhaps you could do that, yeah. But
okay.
So this is not the most general thing. There may be other constitutive relations in this class D.
Okay.
In fact, they look very similar to this, but a bit more complicated to write down, but they're in the paper. But this is a pretty general thing. So for up to second order charged fluids, we have checked that everything in dissipative class is of this form. And we have an argument that for higher orders, there's some slightly more general thing where these n's become some derivative operators and stuff. But here, I just want to build some intuition saying that if you look at constitutive relations which have this structure, then what you get is a delta that's manifestly a square. So at the leading order where n doesn't involve derivatives, you will have to constrain that this be positive definite, the coefficient here. But at any orders, at any higher orders, you get something that multiplies a square that you already know, so it's not constrained. Okay, so the structure of dissipative hydrodynamics is always something like this. Okay, and now this has become a very easy task. Now, if I ask you what are the tensor structures that give you dissipation at 27th order, then all you have to do is write down tensors with four indices out of beta and g and 27 derivatives. That's an easy task. That's just writing down tensor structures. You don't have to impose equations of motion. You don't have to impose a second law. That's all implicit.
So it doesn't have to be four
tensors. The most general thing is it looks almost the same, but the n's become some tensor operators, which may involve some.
Yeah, but if you have arbitrary number of
indices.
Yes.
Well.
So you can keep playing with u, the metric phrases.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you want two external indices, mu and nu,
sure.
And all other indices have to be contracted anyway.
Right.
So if you have more indices, you can absorb them into how you define the tensor. Yeah. But you need at least one Lie derivative of g because you want to be. Yeah.
So, maybe another way to put my question. This is an argument why the dissipation has that specific positive sign.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But then, what's to say you can't have a negative sign of dissipation if you add it? Have a
well, if you flip this sign,
yeah.
If you can find a g which cancels the thing in the equation, then that's also fine. So in general, if I had written down the most general form of this t, then g would not be zero in general, but you get it from some particular algorithm.
I absolutely believe that this is a sufficient condition for delta being positive definite. I don't understand why it's obvious that it's a necessary condition that not only that I not write down a number of these leads on G, but why how do we know generically that there isn't something? I mean, I agree there isn't, but how do you know, how would I know generically that there isn't something that doesn't have one of them?
So, okay, so you're asking, once I've told you all the classes, why are they complete? Why is this everything? So many of the classes are complete by construction. And this one basically is too, because as I said, this is not the most general form, but you can intuit what the most general form can be, because it has to have two external indices. And it has to involve at least one of these Lie derivatives of G, because this measures how you go, that you go away from a static situation, from equilibrium. If you did not have this Lie derivative, then it cannot be dissipative, because it would be in equilibrium. So in this sense, this is very general. It has the numbers of indices you want, and it has this object which has to be there. Okay, let me get somewhere. Yeah. Anyway, so there are two classes which are hydrostatic, which describe a static fluid flow, which means that your space-time manifold has a Euclidean structure, so there's some Euclidean direction, which also means you can write down a Euclidean partition function. This has been studied a lot. Yeah, I should have given some references here. That you can write down a partition function on the base manifold and write down the partition function is total free energy. So what should show up here is the free energy current multiplying this volume element. So if you write it like this, then for these partition functions which describe equilibrium, this object here can have two forms in general. It can either be some scalar object in the direction of beta, the only vector we have in the game, or it can be some vector which is orthogonal to beta, which is okay. It's just useful to decompose it that way and split this hydrostatic class into two classes, okay, depending on whether the free energy current is a scalar in the direction of beta or some orthogonal object. And then it has been shown that if you write down hydrostatic partition functions of this form, if you just write down everything you can here, every vector structure you have, then this defines for you all the transport that is in equilibrium. So for instance, by varying this with respect to the metric, it defines some energy momentum tensor. Okay, I'm tempted to skip this, but okay. Yeah, anyway, let's do it briefly. So you can try to generalize this partition function picture and try to write down some naive effective action. Right? It's just something you can try and see what it gives you if you just write down an effective action with some Lagrangian, which is a function of the objects, the objects you have. And it should be some covariant object, so it's diffeomorphism invariant. If you take such an action and vary it with respect to the metric that defines for you the sum energy momentum tensor, and you can actually show that there's a particular definition of an entropy current in this context, which involves this thing that you get by varying respect to the fluid vector. And then the energy momentum tensor and the entropy current defined this way from the effective action, they solve the adiabaticity equation. Okay, so that's kind of a generalization of this partition function picture to non-equilibrium situations, where you just write down Lagrangians, and that defines for you two classes of transport. One of them is the hydrostatic class. So if you restrict this Lagrangian to hydrostatic configurations, then what you get back is just the partition function. But you can now also have things which are not static. And this defines for you some class of solutions, which are actually very useful, as I hopefully explain. And again, writing down this class of solutions is now a very easy problem, because it's only all you have to do is at any order in derivatives, write the most general scalar Lagrangian involving 27 derivatives and betas and g's without worrying about equations of motion and all that. Sorry?
Have you tried to see like, how the number of trips grows with the order?
Well, I have no formula for that, but they grow quite significantly. Yeah. The higher orders you get a lot of time. Okay. So where are we? We got rid of anomalies once and forever because there are only a finite number of terms. Then I gave you some intuition for constructing dissipative things. And the result that inequality constraints actually only show up at leading order. Then there were some currents which are forbidden by the second law. And now to go beyond, I split the free energy current into a scalar and a vector piece. And the other split I did was whether things are hydrostatic or not hydrostatic. Okay, so there are two hydrostatic classes, a scalar and a vector one. And then there was this Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is manifestly a scalar object, which defines your free energy current of the scalar type, but it's hydrostatic or off equilibrium. Okay, so there are a few things we have been missing so far, which are not there yet. So the free energy current could be of some very particular kind. It could be just be identically zero, or it could be topological in the sense that I will specify. And what we have also not covered yet is whether the free energy current is of the vector type, but genuinely not hydrostatic. Okay, so this is the case with free energy current, which is just zero. We call this class of solutions Berry type because the structure in this class somehow may remind you of something like Berry curvature in some vague sense. But the point here is that this class B of solutions is defined by structures which look like this. So this looks almost like the dissipative class we had before. It's again about writing down tensor structures with four indices and contracting with this. But in the dissipative class, we had a plus here. Now we have a minus here. And if you have a minus here, it's clear that if you plug this in, the equation, the adiabaticity equation, if you multiply this t with a lead derivative of g, you will just get zero, right? Because you have some anti-symmetric object multiplying twice the same tensor. Okay, so this almost trivially satisfies the equation. It gives some interesting transport. It's interesting because you can never get this from the Lagrangians I showed you. And it has some interesting phenomena fall into this category, so things like Hall viscosity, Hall conductivity. If you look at the energy momentum tensor, which describes such phenomena, they're of this form. And okay, maybe I should. I think I should skip this. So these are not. There are two more classes which I've just skipped. There was this topological class, which is a finite class. Again, it's just a finite number of terms which you can just write down. And then what I also skipped was free energy currents, which are not hydrostatic, but vectorial, and they again are of some particular structure. They are defined by some particular other tensor structure, which is analogous to these n's. So the statement is these are the classes of solutions. Each of these classes is either finite, so you can deal with it once and forever, or it is of the form that you have just some tensor structure, either a scalar or a 5-index object or some 4-index object, and all you have to do is classify all structures of this type without worrying about equations of motion in the second law. And whatever you don't construct from such structures is forbidden, is not allowed by the second law. Okay, that's the statement. And now, okay, you were asking about the completeness. I don't have time to prove that, but in the paper we have a proof that this is complete. This is all there is. And the proof relies on looking at entropy currents, basically, and making sure you construct all entropy currents that you can ever get, ever have.
So the conclusion is under the assumption that T mu nu is written in this way that involves one linear metric. So it's like assuming that form the current of the relationship with T mu nu is complete, or even without assumption is complete, that it also implies that T mu nu must be proportional to the linear change.
Oh no, it doesn't have to be in general. No. In some of the classes it is, but not. T mu nu can be any functional of beta and g subject to the second law constraint. That's all the assumptions. And now you can construct all of them at 27th order just by classifying tensor structures. Okay, good. So that's this part of the talk. Questions about this? Okay, let me give you an example to maybe this was all a bit confusing. It becomes clearer if you have an example. Let's look at a neutral fluid at second order in derivatives, and let's assume it's conformal fluid. Okay. Then before imposing the second law, there are five tensor structures which you can write down, let's say with two derivatives. Okay, there's some tensors here, which you don't have to worry about what they are, but you see some vorticity tensors and some shear tensors, and this C has to do with curvatures. But at the end of the day, just from symmetry grounds, there are five things you can write down with two indices and two derivatives. And each of them comes with some coefficient. I've given them names. I've written combinations here because these are the names that are usually used in the literature. But what the classification actually tells us is that this combination wants to be one transport coefficient, and this combination wants to be one coefficient, because if you the classification kind of tells you what is the nicest basis of tensors to work in, what's the most physical basis to work in. So now you can ask these structures in which of the classes do they go. So these three you can all get from a Lagrangian. A Lagrangian density and effective action, which is a function of beta and g. Okay, so if you look at the most general Lagrangian at this order in derivatives and with Weyl invariants, you find that there are three terms you can write, and they correspond to three of these coefficients. Okay, and then there are two more which you cannot get from such Lagrangians. So the first one is genuinely dissipative; it gives you a non-zero delta entropy production. Multiplying sigma cube. So this is dissipative, but it's unconstrained by the second law because of this derivative order reasoning that the sigma cube is suppressed compared to sigma squared, and sigma squared has already been constrained at lower order. And then the last guy you have here, that's this Berry type transport, which is of the form that the energy momentum tensor has this anti-symmetric form in the space of fluid configurations. Okay, so there is some tensor N, which if you plug it in here, you get this structure. Okay, so this is an example how to classify the neutral fluid at second order conformal symmetry. And now let's look at this in a bit more detail. So three of these five coefficients came from a Lagrangian. And if I were to just restrict myself to the Lagrangian class of fluids, if I just look at these Lagrangians, then I would just not see the other two. I would never get them. So I would conclude that these coefficients are zero in that class. Okay. So if I do this restriction, I find that there are two relations, there are two things which vanish. And these relations are, of course, not general, because I've been restricting myself now to these Lagrangians. But they seem to have some meaning, because these have been observed in Einstein gravity. And similar things have been observed in kinetic theory, which is a very different regime. So somehow these Lagrangians seem to know something physical about what's going on.
Sorry, what do you mean? Observed in which sense and knowing in which sense?
So fluids via fluid gravity, people have studied the system, and they found that these relations actually hold in that context.
Okay.
Do they hold if you include higher curvature corrections? Or is
that the... I think they don't hold in Gauss-Bonnet. But yeah, we can speculate what that means. But I'm not sure if Gauss-Bonnet is dual to any sensible fluid. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, we can speculate what that means. But at least in Einstein gravity, these relations hold. So
in Einstein gravity, I'm not familiar with that course. So they turn off the dissipation somehow?
Well, dissipation is still there. But so the first lambda 1 minus kappa is dissipative. So this means
observe that this combination is zero?
Yeah.
This is second order. Well.
This is second order. So this means that somehow Einstein gravity fluids want to minimize dissipation beyond what's required by the second law. It's an observation at this point. Or you can elevate it to a conjecture.
Also lambda one minus kappa is that multiplying something that is positive.
Yeah, lambda one minus kappa multiplies something. Cubic form, so it's not positive definite, so it's unconstrained in the derivative expansion. But Einstein gravity fluids, they set this to zero, so they optimize the entropy production beyond what's required by the second law. So, interesting question: does this extend beyond the second order, and what does this mean? So there have been recent efforts to derive these Lagrangians directly from gravity. Which would be very interesting if one can do this in general. There was some very interesting progress, of course, because these Lagrangians seem to know something about gravity.
I wanted to keep in the end, but maybe it's a different topic. So, isn't it the case that the entropy current is not like uniquely defined?
It's not.
Is not uniquely defined. So, for example, the fluid gravity duality, you can define it using the event horizon, but it turns out that you can define also an entropy current using the event horizon, and they differ. And as far as I remember, they also give rise to different rates of entropy reduction.
I mean, as long as the entropy production is positive, I guess that's okay. I'm just asking for the existence of an entropy current such that I have a second law. And of course, this is never unique because I can always do field redefinitions which shift and shuffle things around.
No, but I just wonder whether you can argue maybe one has lower dissipation rate than the other because of your principle of
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're all subject to the second law, but maybe they're... Okay, I haven't... Okay, I have to think about this more carefully. Maybe let's talk about it. Good, how much time? Oh, well, okay. So let me give you... So this is a proper treatment of Schwinger-Keldysh will be the task of my talk next week. But let me give you some intuition for what's going on. In general, you would expect physics out of equilibrium, physics in density matrices. Density matrices have brass and cats, and you kind of want to evolve them separately. So you would expect that you have to write down some Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, which means you double your fields and your symmetries, and you have this funny time contour for your path integrals, which essentially amounts to having two copies of the system. Okay, a copy which forward evolves and a copy which evolves backward. And a kind of a thermal initial condition. And it's been well known since the 60s that this is a very powerful framework which allows you to describe physics out of equilibrium and dissipation, and you conjecture it also describes gravity and all sort of things, because you've all seen this picture. But the question is, can we make this work in hydrodynamics? Can we understand how to do Schwinger-Keldysh? Okay, so essentially, can we use this class L, these Lagrangians I showed you, and upgrade them by doubling somehow, doubling the degrees of freedom, and do some Schwinger-Keldysh thing to upgrade the Lagrangian to describe also the remaining classes of transport. So what you would want to do, maybe just schematically, you would want to double the sources, introduce some second copy of the metric, and then something you could write down, for example, is any stress tensor you want, multiplying the second copy of the metric, so that if you vary with respect to that, you get that stress tensor. Okay, so this way you could get any stress tensor you want, including dissipation. So this is extremely powerful, this doubling. But you could also immediately get the forbidden things, the things which are forbidden by the second law. Okay, so this doubling is very powerful. It's also very dangerous. If you just double things, you can get whatever you want. So the question is how to control this. And this is really a big problem for understanding effective field theory of all these things systematically in a field theoretic sense. And the question is, can we understand this danger in the controlled context of hydrodynamics, where we now understand a lot of the structure? And we believe the answer is yes. So we found a consistent way of doing this doubling in hydrodynamics with an additional constraint that makes sure you don't get whatever you want, but you get exactly the non-dissipative things, say. You get exactly the transport which is allowed by the second law, but you never get anything that's forbidden. Okay. So we have a way of controlling this doubling, and the way to do that is by postulating some additional gauge symmetry on top of the structure, which controls what's going on, okay? So the observation here is that in this Lagrangian class, there's a free energy current, which is basically just looks like a Landau-Ginzburg free energy current, so it's a Lagrangian density times U. And it turns out that in this class of Lagrangians, this is actually the Noether current for diffeomorphisms along the fluid vector. This is a very familiar statement from things like Wald entropy, where entropy also is the Noether charge of a particular kind of diffeomorphism that is basically like this. Okay, so this U1 symmetry, which I postulate here, is a symmetry whose gauge current, which more or less gauges such diffeomorphisms in some rough sense, and the symmetry current of this U1 symmetry will be precisely this free energy current. Okay. We postulate that on top of doing the doubling, you need to impose some additional gauge invariance. And you can make this work. You can write down a Lagrangian, which gives you all, well, at this stage, it gives you all 7 non-dissipative classes and nothing more. And a bit of advertisement, So next week I'm going to talk about this in detail and explain. I'm going to start from Schwinger-Keldysh path integrals, and we'll see that if you do this properly, you can actually derive, or at least argue where all this comes from, that there should really be a macroscopic gauge symmetry coupling to the entropy current, that this should arise in hydrodynamics, and that there's a lot of interesting structure behind these things, including BRST supersymmetry, which comes with ghosts. And so this gauge theory of entropy will include ghosts, and the ghosts give you dissipation. And at the end of the day, there will be an effective action, which gives you all of the 8 classes of transport, including dissipation, and nothing more. So we believe we have an understanding of how to control Schwinger-Keldysh in this context. Right, so that's it. So we have 8 classes of considered relations which are allowed by the second law, and 1 class which is forbidden. I told you how you can construct all that at any order. I argued that this classification is physical in some sense. It knows something about physical systems, and actually if you actually do calculations in hydrodynamics, the classification tells you what is probably the best basis and the best choice of variables to work in, because it picks them automatically. And I gave you some brief ideas of how the Schwinger-Keldysh works, but I'm going to justify that in a different context. Thank you.
We've had several questions. Okay, so I guess there's a reminder that this here for a little bit over 2 more weeks. Okay, let's go continue with part B of the talk.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.